I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by PASA Sustainable Agriculture. Learn more about PASA's 2021 virtual conference at pasafarming.org/conference.
Good evening, and welcome to the 175th episode of Eating Matters. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting on Heritage Radio Network. I can think of no better way to celebrate the 175th episode of a podcast like Eating Matters than by speaking with Tom Philpott, a leading food politics journalist and former farmer, about his newly released book, Perilous Bounty: The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. The book takes us on an unsettling journey into who, how, what, and where we produce food in this country, and it explores possible solutions that could route us away from disaster as we plunge into an era of climate change. A must-read for anyone interested in our food system. I am so pleased this book has brought him to the show today. Tom, welcome to Eating Matters.
Great to be here.
Okay, so before we get started, I just have to say, I have to ask, have you ever had that experience where you're fighting with somebody about something and you wake up like mad at them already? They don't know you're mad at them, but you have this like, you're like, I'm mad at you. I'm having that same experience with you in this book, I think. I thought I should let you know, which is I'm basically shooting the messenger. So yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm a little mad at myself, I think.
I mean, this book is an incredible read. And, you know, what you outlined, this is not necessarily new information, right, for those of us who have studied food policy, but you put it all in one place with a staggering amount of like data and evidence and, you know, conversations with people on the ground that I'm going to maybe have a hard time sleeping tonight. Did you have that experience when you were writing the book?
Yeah, I definitely had a few of those nights. And one of my favorite authors is this guy, Mike Davis. And he's an incredible writer in Southern California. And he wrote a book about bird flu about 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I heard him on an interview saying that of all of his books, it's the most terrifying one. And he actually had to purge it from his house because it scared him so much.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel like purging this book from my house for the same reason. It's just, yeah, I mean, it's not bringing the good news about the status quo for sure.
Yes. Okay. So let's dig in and just start by, you've been covering the food and politics, the food politics and ag beat for what, over a decade now. Why did you decide to write this book at this time?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, like what you were saying about a lot of this stuff, a lot of the material in the book is stuff we already know. And, you know, I feel like I kind of came by it, honestly, by, you know, sort of working in the trenches for all those years. I think I started writing about food politics in 2005. And I think I just reached a point where I think it was during the California drought, and I was doing a lot of reporting on the drought. So this would have been 2015, 2016 in there. And just thinking about how, you know, when you dive into it, that area is, you know, California Central Valley is overstripping its water resources with no end in sight. And that's pretty shocking for the food system. And right around that time, I guess it was 2013 is when the real germ for the book happened. So I was doing all this drought reporting, And then the Midwest had this really brutally wet spring, just incredibly, you know, it's just these incredible storms that put all the soil on the move. And I did a little bit of reporting on that. And I just had this realization, like, these are the two crucial nodes of our food system. And both of them are in a state of ecological unwinding, ecological degradation, with no end in sight. And in both cases, climate change was making it worse. And I thought, you know, putting those two things together and teasing them out would be a really powerful frame to look at this question. And so that's kind of how it came together. But, you know, I had done reporting, especially in the Midwest, but I've been reporting on both of those areas, you know, for almost a decade by that time. And so that's sort of how the germ of the book came together.
And okay, so you profile the Central Valley in California and the Corn Belt in the Midwest. Where, for those of us who are not like California natives, where is the Central Valley, and what kind of foods? Let's start there. What kind of foods come out of this region?
Yeah, I mean, it really is a remarkable area. So it's like the spine that runs up the middle of California from not too far north of LA, almost to the Oregon border. And so it's got, on one side, it's got the Sierra Nevada Mountains, which a lot of people, when they go to California, it's a popular destination to go to Yosemite Park. It's right in the Sierra Nevadas. There are these grand, spectacular mountains that go all the way up. And then on the other side, you get these coastal mountain ranges that go up California. And so the valley is right in the middle. And I think, you know, travelers going through there might pass through there on the way from LA to San Francisco. And it is essentially the way that it really isn't a desert. And we can get into explanations for why that is. But the way that it's been rearranged since it became a U.S. state, since California became a U.S. state, it's like this desert in the middle of California. I remember one time I was doing research for the book in Fresno, which is a city right in the middle of the, you know, lower down in the Central Valley, in the southern part of Central Valley. And it was 110 degrees, just baking hot in the summer. And I remember just needing to escape the city and driving into the Sierra Nevada Mountains. And, you know, 25 minutes from Fresno, it was suddenly 60 degrees and just beautiful rivers flowing everywhere.
Wow.
And so that's the kind of place it is. Absolutely transformed by U.S. settlement, not very long after the U.S. took it over in the 1850s, basically becomes completely rearranged, and the incredible water resource that comes from the snowmelt from the Sierra Nevadas that fed these incredible rivers have all basically been diverted into and dammed and turned into basically a big spigot for agriculture in the area. And, you know, loads and loads of wetlands drained for agriculture, and entire lakes have vanished, have been essentially, you know, because the water source for the lake was cut off, the lakes ended up drying up. But there's a lake called Lake Tulare in the southern Central Valley that was the biggest lake west of the Mississippi, and it no longer exists because of agriculture. And there are many examples like that in the Central Valley of just mind-boggling change that has happened since U.S. settlement.
Is this area different in terms of the experience of redirecting waterways to really become a huge, like, spigot for agriculture? Is this unique to the Central Valley area, or has this been happening all throughout the coast?
There's nothing quite like it on the coast. I mean, I think we can also say there's not much quite like it in the world. And why I say that is that California, just in general, has this really unique Mediterranean climate. And I believe it's the largest Mediterranean climate in the world. And really all that means is that it's situated at a certain place in the continent, and it, has really, long and typically hot summers. In the really coastal areas, not quite as hot, but long, hot summers that are very dry, and then mild winters. And so what that means is that, great growing season, really long growing season, just exactly the opposite of up in New York State or New England. The limiting factor in Mediterranean climates is water, because, it's tends to be dry in the summer. But this magnificent resource of the Sierra Nevada really makes it unique, this, huge spine of mountains that essentially catches the weather generated in the South Pacific all winter. It's basically all the water that evaporates in the South Pacific and goes into the atmosphere is funneled into these things called atmospheric rivers because they carry so much water, and sent to California, and they essentially hit the Sierra Nevada and drop as snow. So you get this incredible snowpack. And I can't think of another area in the world that has quite that combination of this incredible snowpack alongside a Mediterranean climate. And so that's what makes California so unique. And then in terms of the change that has been wrought by U.S., the U.S. state, it is considered one of the most transformed landscapes in the world. And so, once again, there's not very much like that anywhere. I think up the West Coast and, up in the Pacific Northwest, the dams that you get there are more for electricity generation is a lot more the purpose up there. There isn't quite the same emphasis on, creating dams and aqueducts to divert water to agriculture.
So given the incredible kind of climate, how much food, it comes out of California right now, and what types of foods? And then, I also want to ask you the same questions for specifically the Central Valley, which you focus quite a bit on in the book.
Yeah. So, basically California provides the majority of U.S. grown fruits and vegetables. Now, there are growing imports from places like Mexico and Chile. But in terms of U.S. grown fruits and vegetables, the majority come from California as a whole. And then you think about things like nuts, specifically almonds and pistachios and walnuts. Essentially, all of that comes from California. In fact, 80% of the globe's almonds come from California. Almost all of that in the Central Valley. So there are two other massive valleys that aren't as big as the Central Valley, but that do produce a lot of food, and that's the Salinas Valley and the Imperial Valley. And they're more known for fruits and, basically salad greens, I should say. That's where really... The sort of basis for salad greens. And, if you look at the numbers, stuff like salad greens, lettuce, arugula, things like that, upwards of 80% come from California. The Central Valley has a good amount of that, but vegetables like broccoli and cauliflower are all widely grown in the Central Valley. But, what it's really known for and what it really is a powerhouse in is fruit, and then also almonds and pistachios. Incredible amount. Probably 80% of the almonds you've consumed in your life are from the Central Valley. There are some Spanish imports and things like that, but for the most part, almonds come from California. And I think in most of the country for most of the year, when you go to a supermarket and you browse the produce aisle, the fruits and vegetables come from California with some imports mixed in. And so it is really just the sort of vegetable and fruit basket of the United States.
You have this one stat in the book. I think it is less than 1% of U.S. farmland the Central Valley occupies less than 1% of U.S. farmland, but it turns out something like a quarter of the nation's food or something really scary like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's it is incredibly productive.
So you also profile a farmer at the early on in the book, Joe Del Bosque, whose experience provides a good example of the issues that, you know, it seems like many of the farmers in the region are contending with. Can you tell us a little bit about what some of these challenges that he and his farm are facing?
Yeah, I really thought he was an evocative example because he's farming in the San Joaquin Valley, which is the southern part of the Central Valley. And he's got about half his acreage is devoted to almonds and the other half is devoted to melons. And his melons are really, really good. He does organic melons and he does a variety that, you know, this is not the sort of flavorless melon you get at the motel in the morning, you know, when you're, you know, wolfing down your breakfast.
This is not like the bullshit that you get in your fruit salad.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a drugstore.
Yeah, when you go to the drugstore and they have a pre-cut fruit salad, this is not that. It's really, really good. There's some kind of heirloom variety that are very delicate to harvest, and so they resist mechanical harvest. And so he's got crews of farm workers. And he's a bit of a unique character because he is Mexican-American, and his parents were migrant farm workers. And he's like that one in a million that was able to scrimp and save. And, you know, his father was an excellent grower who, you know, moved from the fields to being kind of a farm manager and just sort of knew how to run a farm operation. And Joe got into that, you know, as a, you know, fairly young. And so has incredible knowledge and skill, but, you know, is from that world. His parents were both born in Mexico. And so he's got these melons that sell at Whole Foods. I think Whole Foods is the number one buyer of them. And they, in the right season, they make it out nationwide. Like I, you know, was getting them in Austin, Texas after I interviewed him. And I was hearing people talk, you know, they're available up in New York at the right time of year, you know, just a major supplier to Whole Foods, during his season. And the other crop is almonds, and the almonds are not organic. They're just sort of sold into the commodity almond market. And in both cases, he's got a lot of problems, you know, because basically, you know, we should set up that this magnificent resource of the Sierra Nevada snowmelt has been declining rapidly on average in recent decades because of climate change. And part of it is just sort of the complicated California weather patterns where if you miss, if one or two of those atmospheric river storms just don't happen in a given year, just for random reasons, you essentially can go into drought and not really have any significant snowpack to speak of. And so as the snowpack has dwindled, people have more and more in that area relied on groundwater. That is this other incredible resource, the underground lakes, essentially, in California, that, you know, basically were filled up over, you know, centuries and centuries of this water flowing through the Central Valley. Some of it percolates downward. So you get this incredible store of groundwater. And so farmers have been reverting to the pump and pumping up that groundwater and essentially taking it to dangerously low levels. And so you got a failing snowpack and this dwindling aquifer, and that's sort of the California conundrum in a nutshell. And so he's really at the very edge of that, where he, you know, his melons actually are fairly water efficient, but they're super labor intensive. And as, you know, basically California joins the 20th century, joins, you know, like the rest of the labor force won things like minimum wage and time and a half overtime during the Great Depression. But farm workers were excluded from that for reasons essentially of racism. And so California is slowly bestowing those rights onto farm workers. And so, you know, basically Joe will tell you, like, look, if I have to pay, you know, a minimum wage of like $14 an hour, and in our harvest season, we essentially rely on overtime because we have fields that need to be harvested immediately, or we're going to lose the melons. And so there's a lot of overtime. I'm not going to be able to do it anymore. And, you know, as much as I support, and I think those laws are incredibly important, it is this conundrum for the area. And we've already seen a lot of mechanization going on there. And then for his almonds, you know, the water problem looms large because in his area, there is no groundwater to speak of. Like, he basically has to rely on water diverted from the Sierra Nevada snowmelt. And if it fails that year, then he's got to buy some on the open market at incredibly expensive prices. And so what he has to do is he's got to divert all of his water from his melons in dry years. And so a couple of years during the drought, he didn't have any melons at all because he had to divert all the water to almonds. And he sees that as not a sustainable situation going forward. So he's this incredibly successful farmer, you know, basically the one in a million farm worker kid who grows up and becomes a landowner. And he is, you know, not sure how long his business is going to go on and if he can pass it over to his kids. He, you know, he's just right there at the cutting edge of all these problems. And he figures that essentially it will, in the end, become just an almond farm and later a pistachio farm. Because the reason why pistachios is that as they get lower and lower in the water table in the area, and he'll have to buy some of this groundwater, the water gets more and more full of these basically salt. It becomes high salt water, and almonds can't grow with a certain amount of salinity, and pistachios are more tolerant. And so he figures because of the labor question, he's going to end up with just selling, you know, having an almond farm that is a completely stressful every year figuring out where his water is going to come from. And so I just feel like he's a bit of a microcosm for some of the hard decisions that are going to be made in the Central Valley going forward. And I think we need to think real hard about relying on it so much for stocking our grocery store shelves going forward.
Here's a question. How much water do we have left in California before all of the like underground aquifers, all the groundwater is totally depleted?
That is a really good question that there should be an answer to. There's a guy that I quote a few times in the book, this incredible scientist named Jay Famiglietti. He's a water researcher for a couple of different California university institutions. And what he says is that the technology exists to find out. Like, they could, you know, the oil industry has a pretty good idea of what reserves are in places with lots of oil, like Saudi Arabia. Like, you can do, you know, it's expensive science, but you can do the science and figure out the reserves. And then the oil companies make decisions on how much to invest in this well based on how much oil is there. But no one has done that research in California. No one has funded that research. What research that they have done is they can tell how much water gets withdrawn every year. And the way they do that is NASA satellites go up in orbit around the Earth, and so much water is withdrawn that the gravitational pull of the Earth changes. And and based on that, they can get a pretty good idea of withdrawals. And the withdrawal levels that they're seeing in California consistently are alarming. So they know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, and but it's, I can tell you that they're in the book and they're huge. And but what Jay is fairly confident of is that they can't keep doing that forever. Like, they can't keep doing that for very much longer. And we're already seeing signs of the overdraft. Like I said, the salt levels get really high. The In some cases, when you get to lower down in the basin, you get really high arsenic levels. This is a naturally occurring chemical that's toxic to people. And, you know, in the aquifer, when it's, you know, in a fairly normal state, it's at a level too low to worry about. But it gets to points where it's 10 parts per billion, which, you know, is very dangerous. And you've got farm worker communities in California whose water, the water level has dropped so low that they are consistently getting getting arsenic in their well water and having to buy bottled water. And people are spending thousands of dollars a year. These are people with average incomes of $20,000 devoting significant portions of it to buying bottled water because the water that they're getting is poisonous. And these are all signs that the answer to your question is not very much longer, definitely not forever.
Yeah. So one of the great known villains, if you will, of food and environmental advocates and people is, of course, Monsanto, now Bayer.
Yeah.
But in your book, you talk about one company that's probably lesser known for the destruction that they have caused on the natural resources in California for profit. And that's, of course, the Wonderful Company.
Yes.
Can you tell us what they produce and the impact that it has had on California agriculture, especially when we think of things like water rights usage and the dwindling water supply?
So there's this very canny, smart couple named Stuart and Linda Resnick, and they're Los Angeles residents. They don't come from a farming background, but they figured out pretty early, they're really masterful marketers, and they figured out pretty early that buying farmland in California with good water rights, and when you can't get good water rights, to figure out other ways to get hold of water would be really valuable going forward. And so that's what they've done. And so they've become the dominant, I think, I'm pretty sure they're the biggest landowner in California, or at least in the Central Valley, the biggest agricultural landowner, that is to say. And they are also very, very excellent marketers. And we've all seen, everyone who's listening to this will have seen their handiwork. If you go into most supermarkets in the United States, you'll see a big pistachio sign. I think pistachio, wonderful, you know, in the produce section. And they, with their, you know, incredible marketing skills, have done a great job of increasing demand and sort of the appetite for stuff like almonds and pistachios. And they are the dominant players in those two markets. And they're also the reason why the pomegranate has become a mainstream item in the United States. I remember learning about pomegranates in the 80s. I was working in a restaurant in Austin as a teenager, and we had these Iranian coworkers, and they produced one day at work a pomegranate. I was like, what in the world is that? And it was a very obscure, you can get it in certain, like maybe a Mexican-American restaurant or a Mexican store. They're used in Mexican culture, but they were not a mainstream thing. And now pomegranate juice is ubiquitous, and there's a pomegranate season. You go to the store and you can get pomegranates. They're completely behind that. They brought pomegranate agriculture, at least they brought it as a massive commercial enterprise to the United States. They famously funded studies showing that pomegranates can cure everything from, I don't know,
so good for you,
erectile dysfunction and, you know, all this other stuff. A lot of that ended up being, you know, overhyped. I'm sure they're really good for you. Anything that red is going to be good for you. Some of the little feet, you know, these little oranges, these little citrus fruits, cuties, and things like that.
Yeah.
They've taken these commodities, they've taken these products, commodified them, put tons of marketing into them, and really blown them up. Almonds were not very much consumed in a place like China, and they and the California Almond Board, but with the Resnicks very much, in league, have have really promoted them hotly in China. So there's this booming market for almonds in China. And they're actually, you know, a lot of cultures don't have the idea of the snack. The idea that, hey, between meals, I'm going to nibble on some stuff. And they're pushing hard to get snack culture established in places like, you know, various places in Asia, India. And so they're master marketers, and they got hold of a thing called the Kern Water Bank. And so the idea of the Kern Water Bank, so Kern is in the southern part of the Central Valley, mm-hmm. Incredibly full of sort of industrial scale agriculture. There's a lot of Resnick, wonderful land in that area. And there was a thing called the Kern Water Bank that the idea of it was, and I should say that this water that comes from the Sierra Nevada, it doesn't just go to farms. 80% of it goes to farms, but a lot of it also goes to places like Los Angeles and other metropolitan areas to, you know, for people, to, you know, for the water supply in various cities. Mm-hmm. And you know, that can be a very political question, because there are municipalities that don't have a lot of money and that need to secure water. So the Kern Water Bank was established to capture, it's literally a water bank, and it was established to capture water going through the Central Valley in good years, and then it could dole it out in drought years to cities in need of water. And the Resnicks got the Kern Water Bank in a sweetheart deal. They actually bought this public bank. They had the controlling interest in it. And so when there's a drought, they are sitting on this supply of water that they can divert to their own farms. If they feel like that's the most profitable use of it, they can sell it at really high prices if that's the most profitable use of it. And so they become these water barons of California that who also, you know, dominate these markets that I've already mentioned. And they also are the sort of geniuses behind Fiji Water, which is like, let's go to this this island in the South Pacific and let's bottle up the groundwater from this island and sell it for you know, ridiculous price in the United States. And, you know, let's, instead of drinking filtered tap water, let's import water from Fiji. And another just, you know, marketing home run by the Resnicks. And so that's basically who they are. And they're very well connected. They give a lot of money to particularly Democratic politicians. So they have a lot of juice with Democratic politicians in Sacramento, the California capital, and also DC. I remember a high official from the Obama administration's USDA actually went to go do be the chief lobbyist for the Resnicks after her time was up with USDA, and she was just recently advising the Biden administration on some of its ag policy choices. This is just a very common occurrence with the Resnicks. They're just very, very, very canny. They're very tight with the California senators. I don't know so much about Harris, but they're definitely tight with Feinstein and Barbara Boxer, Kamala Harris's predecessor. And so they're really good at securing water rights. And, you know, another big issue, just I'll say real briefly, is the San Francisco Bay Delta, which is this the delta that we've all seen when you go to San Francisco. And it essentially is this incredibly, it goes, you know, more than 100 miles inland from San Francisco. And it's where these rivers used to, a bunch of the rivers used to have a confluence there before all the dams. But it's still an area that is this incredibly rich ecosystem that needs a certain amount of water. And if you talk to the agricultural interests, they'll tell you that you're just letting water go off into the sea if you let it go through there. But it's this incredibly rich ecosystem that has all these different species of birds and fish that rely on it. And so there's this constant push-pull between farm interests and the federal government that control the San Francisco Bay Delta over how much water should go into it. And the Resnicks are very good at lobbying to get their way with how much water goes in, how much water goes through and how much is diverted to, things like the Kern Water Bank and ultimately to their farming enterprises. And so that's sort of who they are. They're absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. And they're also trying very hard to keep people, to keep farmers in the almond and pistachio business. You know, there's no effort to diversify.
Always trying to get, they want the market for almonds and pistachios to keep growing. They need continued growth for the price to keep going up. Or at least to hold steady. We'll see in the second part of the book, we talk about the corn and soybean belt, where corn and soybean prices are always hovering at the cost of production or below the cost of production, just a terrible business. And to avoid that with almonds, you need, constantly growing demand. And that's sort of the point of all this marketing in China. But if you're going to meet that demand, then you've got to keep supply going too at a certain rate. And so they're always trying to get farmers to put in almonds and pistachios to just keep the whole system going. And so I've got a thing in the book that you're probably thinking about where they are recruiting farmers and talking about the amazing amounts of money that you will make, if you make these big investments in putting, you're talking millions of dollars worth of investments in putting in an almond grove. If you make those, you can actually make a lot of money in almonds. That's their push, and they're very much about, we've got to keep fighting and lobbying for our water rights. Those people in Sacramento and Washington are trying to steal our water, and we got to, hold their feet to the fire. And that's sort of their whole, their whole strategy.
Yeah. One of the things I found particularly disturbing was the emergence of farm ownership as an asset class. Mm. What are the long-term repercussions of this trend, and is it happening anywhere else in the country?
It is happening. What I have found recently is that it's really an emerging thing in the Delta area, the sort of Mississippi River Delta area, that there's a lot of interest in buying up farmland there and doing sort of industrial scale agriculture. And I think the implication of it is that
first, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I should have actually asked you to explain what an asset class, what this means.
Ah, yes. An asset class. And this is an important distinction for investors. And so, I used to, before I was writing about food politics, I used to be a financial journalist. And one thing I learned when I was doing that is that what Wall Street wants is that they want to tell investors a story. It's very narrative driven. So they want to have a story to tell investors. And so when your story is good enough, you can develop what's called an asset class, and you can pitch it to investors as something that you want to have in your portfolio for diversification. And so stocks are an asset class and bonds are an asset class. And those are the two main ones. And so you're sort of, convincing your clients that you've got to have some stocks in there. You've got to have some bonds in there. And farmland ends up being this. So the story that they tell about farmland is that, look, first of all, they're not making any more land. I think Mark Twain said that, land is this scarce commodity that, no one's going to make more land to put you out of business. And then we've got a growing global population that's going to need to eat. We've got people moving to higher resource diets, like things like meat and almonds. To meet the demand for those things, that's going to make land that can produce those things more and more valuable. And when you buy farmland, you're buying an asset that can appreciate. So it can, it can go up in price. You can sell it for more than you bought it for 10 years from now. And it also throws off an income stream in the meantime. So that's really nice too. Sort of like a dividend paying stock. And so that's good. And then when you have an economic crisis, let's say you get a recession, people still have to eat. And so if you're in the media business and there's a recession and ads dry up, you see lots of bad stuff happen in media, lots of layoffs. You know, we've all seen it many times in the past 20 years. But people are in a recession. Even if they've lost their job, they still have to eat. And so you're buffered from economic downturns because for that very reason. And so they started pitching this as an asset in the 90s, and it got official status as an asset class. And what that means is that there's now an index like the S&P 500 that you can go look at a chart and see how it's been doing for the past 20 years. And it is something that mostly for very wealthy people is considered something that you should have in your portfolio. But of course, there's also funds, like not just hedge funds, but investment funds that you can invest in that will put farmland in your portfolio. And to me, one of the things that's scary about it is it completely commodifies farmland. And so the owners are completely separate from the area. They don't live there. They have no connection to the operation. Some professional manager who's been hired manages the property. And if you don't have to live there, then it becomes that much easier to turn the area into a sacrifice zone. And that's one of the things that I that really hit me with this book, is that in both the places that I sort of touched down in, California and the Corn Belt, in the California ag regions, the living conditions are brutal. The air is foul. The water, we've been talking about the water quality issues, are universal in that area, in both those places, polluted water. And, you know, if you're, you know, a shareholder in one of these farmland funds, or you're, you know, a director of a big hedge fund that's buying this stuff, or, you know, on the board of Harvard, which is, you know, I also documented Harvard getting up to some of this stuff. You know, you're not in the middle of that crisis. Your neighbor's not going to yell at you because their well went dry or their water is polluted. And, you know, the other thing is that that land is then explicitly run to make a profit. And the time horizon of that profit is chosen by the director. There's no one, like if I own a piece of land, or, you know, if most people own a piece of land, you think about passing it on in better shape than what you found it. But if you're a investor in one of those operations, you've got a horizon of like 20 years, and all you care about is how much profit you can wring out of it over those 20 years. And so I think that is one of the big problems that's happening in California, is that there is a good amount of this institutional ownership that's completely divorced from the reality on the ground.
I was thinking about this in particular because it was recently announced that Bill Gates is now the largest private farmland owner in the US. And yes. I don't know if this is, you know, somehow related to this trend. I'm assuming it is, and hopefully he's a better actor, but just the idea that you know, just the very idea that you're owning farmland strictly for financial gain is just terrifying, I think.
Yeah. And I don't have any, you know, knowledge of what he's up to by doing that.
I don't know.
But I'm sure it's the similar logic that growing population, a scarce commodity, this is probably something good to own. And I believe some of what he does own is in the Delta region, which I think is really interesting. Probably not for this conversation why it's so interesting, but I do think it's a really interesting thing that investors are settling on that area.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have you on because I have been paying particular attention to, I think that like land use, land rights are going to be the next big thing that we need to be focusing on down the road. And this just seems to be further evidence that is, you know, going to be something that we're going to be talking about a lot more, in addition to water rights. So, and I, you know, I want to say for this episode that I'm focusing our conversation a lot around what's happening in California, but your book lays out in the same way, kind of makes the case for like everything that's happening in the Corn Belt as well. We are just, there's like equal time dedicated to it in the book. I'm just particularly interested right now in what I learned about California. And the flip side of drought is, of course, flooding. So yes, we're still staying in California. But yes, and I this is not something that like I think that people tend to associate with a problem in California. But what you describe is the very real possibility that there could be a catastrophic flood in the, you know, next couple decades.
Yes. And that was a big eye opener for me as well. And it really kind of goes back to this interesting weather pattern in California, because what happens is so weather for the Western North American coast is generated in the South Pacific, like I was saying before. And there's this this pressure ridge that comes into the area. And I'm not, you know, like I can't break down the science of what that is exactly, but it's a weather concept that this ridge of high pressure will come in to California in the months, in the summer months, basically, let's say March, April to October, November. You get this high pressure ridge. And so this weather coming from the South Pacific gets shunted northward to, you know, Washington, Oregon, British Columbia, and those regions are known for their wet weather, and that's basically why. Or, you know, south into southern Mexico, and California doesn't get it for those months. In the wintertime, this high pressure ridge tends to go away, and that's when California gets all of its weather, and most of its precipitation happens in the winter. And these giant storms come in the winter. And like I said, one or two of these storms not happening can be the difference between a mega flood and a drought. The California drought of the first half of the last decade, like 2011, 2016, was basically based on a lot on a high pressure ridge staying there in the winter. And so the winter weather never came to California. So the snowpack never formed. And that's what the drought was. So what climate change is doing is it's getting hotter and hotter in the South Pacific. The atmospheric temperature is really high. The water temperature is really high. And so you're getting these, you're getting more water going up there than ever before, and you're getting storms that are really, really heavy. And so that's sort of the climate aspect of it. But I should back up for a second and say that people who have studied the sort of paleo history of California, the paleo climatological history of California, looking at things like sediments and streams and things like that, have found that the past couple hundred years when the U.S. was a major presence in the North American continent have been fairly calm in California in terms of both droughts and floods. But if you go back before that, if you go back the past 1,000 years, there have been 5 mega floods in California, 5 or 6 enormous floods in California that have essentially put the entire Central Valley underwater. And the last one was in 1861, 1862, at the very dawn of California statehood. There was this flood that most people in California now, even people that are history buffs of the state, who grew up there, who have roots in California, a lot of people don't even know about this. But this basically in the December of 1861, it started to rain. One of these atmospheric river storms started, and it didn't stop for about 40 days and 40 nights, straight out of the Bible. And so this massive rainstorm comes on top of snow that's already been packed into the Sierra Nevada mountains, melts the snow, and you get this water gushing in from the mountains, the rain itself falling. And the entire Central Valley was under 10 to 20 feet of water. And, you know, basically it was a big catastrophe. We don't know how many people died, but a lot of people did die. it didn't affect San Francisco that much. San Francisco, basically is right above this delta that where the water just gushes out to the sea, but it it really hammered the Central Valley, and basically people forgot about it. It was this disaster that happened, and Californians shook it off, and basically resettled. And one of the things that if you think about the Central Valley in 1861, 1862. There were Native Americans living there, and contemporary accounts show that they very quickly, early on, realized what was coming and cleared it out. Lots and lots of accounts of Native Americans clearing out. There weren't that many white settlers there, and the farming there was tended to be basically cattle agriculture. Hundreds of thousands of, I think about 100,000 cattle drowned in the event. But the loss of life was, it existed, but it was fairly limited. And if you flash forward to today and think about what the Central Valley is like today, it would be much, much more of a disaster than it was in 1861, 62. But so what this paleo record shows is that these kinds of storms recur about every 100 to 200 years, something like that. And we haven't had one for about 150 years. And that's already scary enough to me that this is a thing that happens and that like, we've just been lucky that it hasn't happened since California's become this, massive economy and population center. But then when you add climate change onto it, the hotter climate means more evaporation, more water in these atmospheric rivers. And there is a team of scientists at UCLA that have sort of modeled the paleoclimate and put it on top of climate models that are happening now. This guy named Daniel Swain at UCLA, you can Google him. And what he figures is that more likely than not, a storm of this magnitude is going to hit and the entire Central Valley is going to, quite likely be inundated and put underwater. And that has grave implications for the food system. As you said before, about 25% of the food that, that we consume comes from there. And also just the environmental and human costs are staggering. So now many millions of people live in the Central Valley. Cities like Stockton and Fresno and Bakersfield are fast-growing cities. They're drawing people from L.A. and San Francisco who get priced out of those markets, the Bay Area generally. So these are very fast-growing areas. Cattle agriculture has, exists still. Massive, massive amounts of dairies. California is now the biggest dairy producing state in the United States. Produces more than Wisconsin. And most of those dairies are concentrated in the Southern Central Valley. And dairy cows are huge. And I, did some numbers in the book about how much bigger they are now than they used to be. And just the logistics of trying to move hundreds of thousands of these giant dairy cows out of a flood is staggering. And then you think about like what happens to them when they drown and just sort of the bio waste implications. And then you think also about the chemical intensive nature of the agriculture, the fertilizers, the pesticides, all that stuff being concentrated in the area. What happens to it when it comes underwater. It's also, I think, kind of little known outside of California what a big oil producer it is. And most of the oil production happens in the Southern Central Valley. And so now you've got petrochemicals involved in this sort of toxic stew. And it's just, it's a staggering thing that will probably happen in our lifetimes. And it is one of those things that does keep one up at night for sure.
Yeah, that we're not prepared for. It seems
I question, how can you prepare for something like that?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, you can, yeah, I don't know. I guess, and I think that just hearing you kind of detail out, you think like a flood, ooh, devastating, right? But like when you really think through exactly what that entails in terms of all of the, like the pollution, like you said, the loss of life, the like trillion dollars worth of damage to infrastructure and just yes. everything. I just... It's hard to wrap your head around. And it's yet not talked about at all. Even, you know, I think we're really consumed with like wildfires in California.
Yes.
Which are also
as we should be.
As we should be, right?
Okay. We are going to take a really quick commercial break, but we will be right back. So stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by PASA Sustainable Agriculture, cultivating environmentally sound, economically viable, and community-focused farms and food systems. PASA Sustainable Agriculture's annual conference is one of the largest gatherings of sustainable farmers, food system professionals, and changemakers in the nation. The 2021 virtual conference takes place January 19th to February 5th. And features more than 90 sessions on topics that include soil health, climate change, crop production, livestock grazing, urban agriculture, community building, food justice, and much, much more. Don't miss keynote speaker Robin Wall Kimmerer, scientist and author of Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants. Learn more about PASA Sustainable Agriculture's 2021 virtual conference and register online at pasafarming.org/conference.
And we're back, where today I'm speaking with journalist Tom Philpott about his new book, Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It.
Okay, so I want to go east to the Corn Belt and just briefly, I know it's really hard to summarize just all of the problems happening with the way that we farm in the Midwest today, but what are some of the negative externalities of how and what we are producing in this region?
In the Corn Belt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where is this, just Iowa, or is it the surrounding area?
It's
as
kind
well?
Of centered. Think of Iowa as the center of it. And then it goes a couple of states east out to Ohio and a couple of states west out to, let's say, the Dakotas. Iowa is really sort of the buckle of the Corn Belt, let's say. And so just to make a long story short, it's this other incredible region. It's as unique, you know, I was talking about California and its Mediterranean climate. Well, the Corn Belt has got this incredible, it's a prairie region that had this glaciation that happened, you know, some number, many, many years ago that having the glaciation brought all this silt down from the north and then having it'd be prairies with these incredible herds of, you know, this incredible population of bison and other animals, just created this incredible store of topsoil. Obviously, people lived there too and played a major role in essentially managing those animals. And so when the U.S. takes it over in the 1850s, around that time it starts settling it, it's just this incredible stash of topsoil, some of the richest. I mean, there are three or four regions in the world that have topsoil of this quality over an expanse this big. Argentine Pampas, Ukraine, very few others. And another thing that I think people don't always get is that there were also huge amounts of wetlands, and these wetlands were incredibly biodiverse, supporting plant life that sequestered all kinds of carbon. Of course, there was all kinds of carbon sequestered in the prairie soil, in the drier parts. But the wetlands, incredible sequestration of carbon, incredible amounts of biodiversity, fauna, birds. It was the engine of avian diversity, biodiversity in this continent. All of it has been paved over. Essentially, all of it has been plowed up. And, you know, fast forward to today, The great majority of it devoted to two crops, corn and soybeans, that are planted at the same time and harvested at the same time, leaving the ground essentially bare all winter until the next summer when the canopy of the plant comes up and buffers the ground a little bit. And in those bare months, we get these storms that occur. And of course, climate change is making these storms worse. And it is essentially sending this precious topsoil that we've already surrendered half of since U.S. settlement. Stunning amounts of topsoil are going on a move, being washed off of these farms, along with all of their agrochemicals, and being sent into streams and rivers that causing all kinds of downstream problems. You know, externalities you asked about would include foul drinking water throughout the region, just really disgusting messes made in lakes where phosphorus, which is a fertilizer that's applied, feeds algae blooms that make the water toxic in those areas. Also, there's a huge concentration of pork production in these giant CAFOs, and their waste gets mixed into the stream. And then, you know, clear down to the Gulf of Mexico, probably every listener to the show knows about the dead zone that occurs every year, fed by nitrogen fertilizer that blots out this enormous, Connecticut-sized amount of the Gulf of Mexico, sending, you know, fish in those areas scurrying elsewhere and messing up things for fisher people down there. So it's just this cascading set of problems that come from devoting all of your land to just two crops. And then, you know, I just talk in the book about, I mean, I think another big externality is just the really horrible diet that is generated from this, because, you know, corn and soybeans, they go to, you know, feeding the sort of feedlot, confined animals, chickens and pigs and cows, including those, you know, giant factory dairy farms in California. They actually will import corn and soybeans in the Midwest. But they also course through the food system in the form of cheap soy oil, corn oil, high fructose corn syrup, other corn sweeteners, just a whole variety of thickeners. You know, essentially, you know, we all know from reading Michael Pollan that, you know, most of the processed food in the middle of the supermarket is essentially tweaks corn and soybeans, whether it's fat or sweeteners from those things. And we also know that the diet produced by this heavy in meat, you know, feedlot meat and heavy in processed food is literally causing a massive public health crisis. And I would say that is, you know, things like diabetes, type 2 diabetes, heart diseases, various kidney diseases are diet related based on the diet that's generated from this. And so one of the things I asked in the book is, you know, who is benefiting from this?
It's literally my next question.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that the answer to it is, you know, it ends up being the main beneficiaries. And, you know, let's go back to the gold rush. The gold rush in California is sort of what made it, an attractive state. It's really what was the sort of impetus for statehood in California. And everyone knows in a gold rush that everyone ends up going bust except for the people smart enough to sell supplies to the gold diggers. And there's a very similar situation happening in the Corn Belt where the main beneficiaries of the system that's causing all these problems and generating this terrible diet are the companies that deliver the inputs, the seeds, the pesticides, and also fertilizers, the very fertilizers and pesticides that end up fouling up water. These companies profit from this situation. And then the buyers of the corn and soybeans, the companies that, you know, essentially turn it into cheap meat, the companies that turn it into these cheap ingredients that become our food, the companies that turn it into ethanol to drive our, you know, gasoline-based transportation system. These are the companies that make out like bandits. And one thing I show in the book is that farmers You know, I think the one correction or the one thing that I'll, I'm already thinking about if there is a second edition is that I portray farmers as generally losing out from this system because they produce so much corn and soybeans. Everyone's doing the same thing. The price falls below the cost of production and they skate by, government subsidies make up the difference. But you got to be really big to be turning out a profit because the margins are so tight. And some of them are big enough to turn out a pretty handsome profit, especially when you add the government subsidies to the game. But there is a way that I didn't get in the book that farmers do benefit. And that is that the price, you know, going back to land as an asset value or as an asset class, the price of land has appreciated dramatically in that area. And so if you're a farmer, you may not be bringing home much in terms of profits from growing corn and soybeans because you have so much competition and the price is so low. And maybe you're skating by on a government check, but the land under your feet, the asset that you own, is dramatically appreciating and you might be a millionaire. And we could say, you know, cash poor and land rich, but land rich is better than land poor. And so they do benefit, especially the bigger ones who hold out and get, you know, giant plantations of land. And so there are fortunes being made in the Midwest by farmers just by holding on to their land. And if you look at a chart, the price of land in the area does drop when commodity prices drop, but it never drops quite as much. And you see the steady trend upwards. Maybe there's times when it goes down a little bit. But, you know, if you bought Midwestern farmland in 1990, you're in really good shape today. And so that is one way that farmers are cut into the system. And one of the reasons why they're willing to keep on with it, because they are, you know, they are benefiting in terms of land value, land appreciation. But the biggest benefactors are the people who own shares in companies like Bayer, which now owns Monsanto, Syngenta, another big giant chemical firm, these, you know, enormous meat companies that have been so much in the headlines for the way that they've been destroying their workers' lives during the COVID-19 crisis. These are the very companies that benefit from this policy, this phenomenon of devoting this gorgeous, incredible swath of farmland in the middle of our country to just two crops, corn and soybeans, because they get cheaper corn and soybeans. That means that lower costs, bigger profits.
And I don't know if this would make it any that much better, but you also point out that a lot of the companies, like, you know, there's with consolidation, there's like what, three, depending on what, you know, where in the supply chain you're talking. But, you know, these major like agribusinesses, they're not even American. they're not American owned.
Increasingly not. I mean, and even, you know, even when they were American, like let's take a company like Smithfield, which is a giant pork producer now owned by a Chinese company, or Syngenta. Well, Syngenta was already a European company, but I think Monsanto is a great example. A U.S. company now owned by this German chemical and pharmaceutical behemoth Bayer. One thing that we should also note is that capital is global, their shareholders are global, and now it's really this sort of like this global elite shareholder class that that really ends up being the main beneficiary. Like, I don't think the U.S. lost out dramatically when this, you know, this Chinese entity bought Smithfield necessarily. I mean, it is this phenomenon of the ownership, you know, the dominant owner of the company now being halfway across the world and even less exposed to the harms being caused. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a fine point that, you know, increasingly these are global companies that are headquartered elsewhere.
Yeah. Okay. So, but they're doing God's work. They're feeding the world, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I do put the lie to that in the book because if you look at so we get this rhetoric. You're exactly right. We get it in California. You know, we're feeding the world when we're, you know, California is moving increasingly over to almonds, which are, you know, I love almonds. They're a luxury food. Like, you don't need almonds.
Right.
And they're creating this, you know, this idea of snacking. Like, who? No one needs to, I mean, snacking is great. I love snacking, but, you know, it's not.
Americans eat too much, period.
Yeah. And it's basically, you know, sort of importing our overeating as well. And so it's all, that all that bit is nonsense. And you're not feeding the world when you grow a bunch of almonds. And in the case of the Midwest, you know, that rhetoric is really strong in the Midwest. And if you look at the main recipients of U.S. corn and soybeans, it's all middle income countries like China on up that are the biggest beneficiaries, because what they're doing with it is creating, you know, massive amounts of meat that it's out of reach for low income, you know, in a place like China or anywhere in the global South. The great majority of the meat that's being produced is too expensive, even though it's cheap. On a grand scale, it's cheaper than meat's ever been produced. It's still too expensive for actual poor people. And so it isn't like U.S. Corn and soybean production or U.S. meat production is feeding the world. It's feeding middle-class consumers and on up who couldn't afford other less destructive alternatives.
So, okay, let's transition to solutions. Which let's say it's going to be an uphill battle. You mean you talk about how California generates $49 billion worth of food per year. I'm imagining, I can imagine their vested interest in keeping it there.
Yes.
is the only answer government regulation? You talk throughout about the impacts of that deregulation has had, the horrible effects of that. So, is this the only answer?
Yeah. I mean, I think in the end it is, because so much of this system that I've laid out, from the infrastructure to create that, those irrigation systems in California, like the private sector did not build those. Those were multiples of $10 billion investments by the state of California and the U.S. government to create this infrastructure to make that $49 billion behemoth that is creating so much profit for people at the top. And in the Corn Belt, you know, you would not have a system where essentially 100 million acres, you know, or actually more than that, this huge, huge swath of land is devoted to two crops without government policy and without the sort of, antitrust deregulation that allowed these companies to get bigger and bigger, where three companies or four companies dominate markets. And so I think there has to be a public policy response to change things, because the incentive structure is geared towards the status quo, unfortunately. Basically, like my main solution for the California problem is just to de-emphasize California as the place that stocks our supermarkets. Mm-hmm. Not to say let's eliminate agriculture in California. It's a great place to grow food. It should grow food, but we can grow a lot more food elsewhere. And I think that I have a big section on this at the end of the book, the local food movement. And I think we'd be very familiar to all that Heritage Radio listeners in general, has done an amazing job of scaling up food production at this point, basically everywhere in the country. And New York City is a fantastic example of that. The green markets that have, you know, grown dramatically over the past 30 years are an example of local and regional food chains growing up, building out, increasing capacity, and supplying more food for those populations in those areas. And it's happened in Texas, and it's happened. I mean, just anywhere you look at on a U.S. map, you've seen this dramatic expansion of local and regional food production. The problem is that it started from a very tiny base, because we basically eliminated that. And despite all this growth, it's still not big enough to make a big dent. And I think the answer is going to have to be that all of these regions get to get, you know, like within the region, get together and look at what are our food production assets? What, you know, what kind of climate do we have? What kind of, you know, season extension kind of infrastructure do we need in a place like the U.S. Northeast? You know, things like hoop houses and high tunnels. Look at assets and needs and figure out ways to build capacity and help farmers, make it easier for farmers to get by and make a profit and support themselves, and start supplying a significantly more amount of food in those areas. And I do think it is going to take government action, because we've done it in this sort of laissez-faire fashion over the past 30 years and made incredible gains, but it just isn't enough. Like, I came into this topic in the early 2000s, and the publication of Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma, I actually reviewed it for Grist, the publication I was working for, when it came out. And, you know, writing the book was an occasion for me to, you know, think back, what have we achieved in these, you know, 15 years since that book came out? And the achievements have been extraordinary, but the system continues. California agriculture has gotten more thirsty for water. The Midwest is growing more corn and soybeans, somebody more land of corn and soybeans. Like, we haven't moved the needle yet. And I think to actually do that, we need government action. Otherwise, we just have these, you know, essentially two food systems, one for, you know, people in the know who can afford this other kind of food, and then just this gross industrial food system that is destroying ecologies, these really, really important ecologies, even as it destroys people's health. And we'll just continue with that. And so that's sort of the case I make in the book.
And you, I mean, you talk about how voting with your fork and eating local, it's not enough, but we still need to do these things, right? This is,
yes, like, necessary, but insufficient.
Right. So I'm not going to eat almond butter anymore. I should eat peanut butter. Oat milk. That's another thing.
I think there's the, you know, that does make good sense, but it isn't that we shouldn't eat almonds. I mean, I think almonds are this incredible food. One thing that we should recognize about almonds is that they have a very narrow, environmental niche that they can thrive in. They can only be grown in Mediterranean climates. Mm-hmm. And so instead of almonds being this ubiquitous thing that you eat every day and eat all the time, treat it as precious. Like, you know, maybe every five times you go to the store and you are buying your nut butter, buy almonds once every five times, like buy almond butter once every five times, and buy peanuts, which have a much bigger ecological niche that they can be grown in, and so are cheaper and are also really, you know, good and high quality and have lots of good benefits. You know, do stuff like that, sort of lower your almond. And I say this as an almond lover. Your expectations for ubiquitous almonds.
But then it gets harder when you talk about vegetables, you know? And I mean, I'm in Detroit, which, by the way, I think there's so much land here that could be farmed in, even in the Detroit city. But, yes. You know, it's hard. So is the idea that we like really eat locally, eat seasonally, and then when we still want to be able to have tomatoes in the winter, then we need to rely on California?
Yeah. I mean,
shouldn't eat tomatoes in the winter.
Luckily for me, I don't like winter tomatoes.
Yeah, they're also terrible. It's a very
good time. It's not a big sacrifice, but but they're, you know, I mean, I think what you're saying is basically right. But I guess the one step further that I would take it is, support Detroit and Michigan grown food in the growing season, but then also get involved with sustainable ag organizations, food justice organizations that will, you know, get involved in policy work and do some of the stuff that I'm talking about, like building out capacity, and thinking of yourself not just as, you know, we are consumers. Our role as consumers are really important. We have to think about our consumption, but we're also players in this larger society, and we can have influence in the larger society and think about more that hat. Like, how can I get involved in the incredible community garden movement in Detroit? How can I get involved in organizations that that support small and mid-sized farmers in the area that are growing for the local area, programs that support young people getting onto land? You know, we talked about just how, you know, cascadingly high, crushingly high land costs are. So it's really, really hard for new and beginning farmers. So getting involved with groups that help such farmers get access to land. Those are the things I'm thinking about. Yeah, in terms of consumption, everything you said is exactly right. Use your food dollars as best you can, because, you know, we need to build those markets.
Are you hopeful about what we could possibly do with the Biden-Harris administration? Or and also especially with Vilsack being back at the helm of the USDA, or probably will be back at the helm of the USDA?
I mean, here, you know, at this point, early on in the administration, we're still in January. I am sort of hopeful that there has been a paradigm shift. I think that a lot of the politics, I think there's a realization, generally speaking, that the politics as usual, restoring the status quo, the pre-Trump status quo, bringing us back to, you know, January 20th, 2016, is not going to cut it. And mm-hmm. I do think that there's a realization that that's true in economic policy. I was very disappointed by the Vilsack pick, because it seemed to signal that with agricultural policy, that was the goal to, mm-hmm. was to go back. But I think that the we're playing with a new deck of cards. The cards have been shuffled. There's new power centers in Washington. People like Liz Warren and Bernie Sanders have a lot of power and a lot of stature. Cory Booker, senator out of New Jersey, has become a real player in progressive agricultural policy and has got some really interesting bills going forward that would not have been imaginable, I think, a few years ago. And he's got allies and people like Sanders and Warren. And I think there are some interesting people in the House of Representatives. And so I think that there is a real chance to hold the Biden-Harris administration's feet to the fire. And I should also say that that Kamala Harris, when she was a senator, was involved in some of that legislation. These bills that are, you know, aren't going to pass anytime soon, but are developing a constituency, an infrastructure, an argument in DC. She was involved in some of those bills. And where she was most impressive is something we haven't talked very much about, and that is worker justice in the food system. Yes. She was involved in a bill that would bring the federal minimum wage and time and a half protections to farm workers, basically taking the California is doing and making it nationwide, which would be fantastic and get a lot of pushback in the South, for example. And so I think there is a lot of reason to hope. And I think that there is a potential for social movements around, you know, I think there's been a really impressive social movement around climate change that, you know, on day one of the Biden-Harris administration, on day one, they revoked the Keystone Pipeline grants, this giant, you know, really destructive pipeline that was going to go through parts of the Midwest from Canada. And that is directly a result of the climate movement and people saying, you know, we don't need or want new fossil fuel infrastructure to be built. We want green energy infrastructure to be built. And I think the fact that he did it on day one is a real, you know, signal that the climate movement that he hears the climate movement. And I guess my big hope is that the climate movement will embrace food and food justice, and food and food justice people will embrace the climate movement, because it really is one thing. And I think that when I think about that, I do get really hopeful that there is an administration that will listen. And, you know, sort of the centrist politics of Biden's past, I think he realizes don't have a purchase anymore, and he's got to find a new way of being. And so that does give me hope.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's a great place to leave it. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Your book is amazing. Where can people find your book? And
They can find it in all of the, you know, usual channels, but the one that I really like is called bookshop.org, which is a conglomeration of independent bookstores, and you can order it online and have it shipped to you. And most of the profits go to independent bookstores. And you can also, you know, in socially distanced fashion, go to your local bookstore, and it's a little bit hit and miss. I've heard it showing up in lots of places. I've heard some places where it isn't, but those would be my favorite. I mean, you know, of course, you can get it on Amazon and Powell's and other places as well.
I had never heard of bookshop.org. That's great. It's really excited.
Cool. Yeah.
Okay, great. All right. Well, this has been so much fun. I know we've gone way over, but promise me you can come back to talk about all of the other things we didn't get a chance to talk about.
I'd be happy to come back anytime.
Okay, perfect. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we're going to leave it there for today. I want to give a really big thanks to our sponsors. Our show intern is Amber Chung. Our show engineer is Jeet Paul. And show music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the HRN website or as a podcast wherever they're found. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. I'm Jenna Liut, and thank you for listening.
Eating Matters is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.